Well, I was thinking about that video that Trump posted yesterday. It was wonderful.
What are you talking about?
Of like him dropping the diarrhea from a plane. It was AI generated.
I did not see that. I did not want to watch that. That sounds terrible.
I mean, it's terrible, but it's like so on brand. It's like funny.
We
The
ready
love
to
of AI that they
record?
have is so fucking crazy.
We
Yes.
stop talking about diarrhea, AI, diarrhea, whatever. Italian brain rot.
Okay.
Diarrhea. Yeah. Yeah, DEI.
DSEI.
DEI
DEIRIA.
diarrhea.
There we go. Yeah, okay. I guess we're still synchronized at this point, right?
We are
So,
synchronized, unless
okay.
one of you push stops, we should be able to go. Okay.
Right, okay.
I'll do the actual intro now.
Yes.
And maybe I'll leave in the diarrhea part. Maybe I'll leave that in real quick. But anyway, maybe I'll leave that in. But here's the actual intro. Hello, critics and theorists. Welcome back to another episode 4 of Critique of the Podcast Forum. Today's episode is about Amadeo Bordiga. I am J.E. Morin. I'm joined today by James Crane
Heyo.
and our resident Italophone and expert on Italian left communism, Sam Thomas.
Okay, how's it going?
As I said, we're talking about Amadeo Bordiga today. Sam, as our expert on Bordiga's life and work, is going to provide us with a little bit of an introduction to his background, his thought, his biography, and all that. So without further ado, I want to pass things off to Sam.
So the articles we're going to be discussing all deal with a similar theme, that of capital and its relationship to the environment. Among these, we'll be discussing Murder of the Dead, an article that came out in 1951 for the party press of Amadeo Bordiga's International Communist Party, oftentimes shorthand referred to as the ICP. Murder of the Dead, or Omicidio dei Morti, was part of a group of articles that Bordiga wrote called that was entitled Sul filo del tempo, or On the Thread of Time. Most of these articles have a very similar structural theme, that of having a section entitled Yesterday, one entitled Today. This is to sort of highlight a type of, this is to highlight the sense of historical invariance that Bordiga and the ICP held. What they mean by invariance is that the central thesis of Marxism, or the central doctrine, is, so to speak, invariant. It doesn't change due to circumstances or changes in attitudes. This is pithily summed up in a 1952 article by the party entitled On the Historical Invariance of Marxism. In it, they decry the falsifiers, that is, the left liberals who try to falsify Marxism, the deniers, like the left liberals, the falsifiers, Stalinists, and the modernizers, that is, the emerging Euro communist movement under what will later be like Enrico Berlinguer. So, why these articles and why now? Well, I think there's something interesting with the fact that Bordiga, among others, is talking about the relationship between capital and the environment in the early 50s. And I think, despite the fact that Bordiga would probably label Adorno, Horkheimer et al. Under the label of falsifiers, there's still, or perhaps modernizers, there's still a way which, in spite of himself, he works in a very similar register to Adorno and Horkheimer, especially regarding the domination of nature that you see in, for instance, Dialectic of Enlightenment. I also think it's worth highlighting because it's some of the first work that tries to deal with the relationship between capital and the environment. And therefore, it's sort of the clearing grounds for later discussions around ecology that you get starting in the 70s. Another interesting element is that in his personal life, Bordiga worked as a civil engineer, so someone who constructed bridges and such. And a lot of the articles that we'll be discussing have him talk about very, very specific technical construction-related things like shipbuilding, bridge building, and so on. And the way in which capital makes those enterprises less efficient than they ought to be. So there's a way in which his personal technical skill as an engineer is brought to bear on these articles as well. As I've mentioned, the the layout of these articles generally goes in the form of yesterday, today. And that's to highlight that the theoretical register, the theoretical output of Marxism that comes about in the 19th century is for the ICP fixed. It does not change regarding circumstances or changes in, you know, popularity and such. And so the yesterday bit usually involves a sort of theoretical exegesis on some particular element of Marxism, which is then brought to bear on some contemporary or pressing present day issue. Now, why would this seem true? After all, if one thing is certain is that a lot of Marxists emphasize the need to look at the material conditions, which are in flux. Well, it's because, again, Bordiga is dealing with parties in Italy that are, for lack of a better term, very revisionist. The PCE, or the Partito Comunista Italiano, which is the mainstream Italian communist position, falls into a vulgar pop frontism that ultimately just devolves into social democracy, especially as you get on into the 60s and 70s. As such, there's a sort of pressing need to defend the actual theoretical output of Marxism from people who just turn it into a sort of an aesthetic signal that is the type of sort of, which you also see, for instance, in sort of modern day watering downs of Marxism among like Instagram influencers and such. So there's a way in which the intransigence or the invariance of Marxism is a medicine which is supposed to combat the illness, so to speak, of revisionism. Now, again, I want to stress that a lot of these deal with the relationship between capital and the environment, and in particular, a lot of them use specific elements of Marx's capital in analyzing them. One particular division is the division between so-called living and... Now, as I've mentioned, these articles deal with the relationship between capital and the environment, and one important element of that is the fact that in 1951, in Polesine, which is in Veneto, or northeastern Italy, there was flooding along the rivers in the area because dams broke down. Most people place the blame for such dams breaking on wartime damage and then neglect by the post-war Italian government. Later on, in 1953, the Piave floods for similar reasons, and that's also in a similar region of Italy. It's northeastern Italy as well. These are very devastating floods. They cause about hundreds of thousands of people to be internally displaced, and some swaths of Veneto to be temporarily rendered uninhabitable. And the later flooding in the Piave is also especially important because the Piave is a national symbol. It would be like if the Gettysburg battlefield, for instance, was destroyed. It's a symbol of national unity as it's the site of a victory over Austria in World War I. So with all that in mind, Bordiga takes the so-called invariant parts of Marxism as a theoretical tool to analyze why these dams were in such poor condition in the first place. After all, if even a national symbol like the Piave is not immune to flooding and destroying the people around it, then what use is the dams and the types of levees along the river? Well, this is where Bordiga actually argues that it's a great opportunity for capital to reinvest fresh variable capital. But for that, we need to have a little bit more of a theoretical exposition on the difference between living and dead labor, and therefore variable and constant capital. So I'll turn that over briefly to my co-host here.
Yeah, so Marx in Volume 1 of Capital introduced the distinction between constant capital and variable capital. Constant capital was things like machinery, tools, buildings, whatnot. These are constant because they're paid for once, and they have a constant rate of, in Marx's language, rate of transfer of the value into the finished product, the commodity that's produced in capitalist production. Variable capital, on the other hand, refers to labor power. This is variable because it's continuously purchased with wages, and the degree to which it transfers value into the finished product is determined by the rate of surplus value, the rate of exploitation which is a variable factor dependent on the wages paid and the hours worked and whatnot. Alongside this distinction, Marx also introduced the distinction between dead and living labor. Dead labor was all the products of labor. So again, things like machinery, tools, and whatnot. Whereas living labor is obviously labor, you know, itself. The distinction between constant and variable capital, we could say, is specific to capitalism. It refers to, you know, the way that things are paid out and the way that things are accounted for in terms of money and value. Whereas the distinction between living and dead labor is a more or less transhistorical distinction. Bordiga will kind of use the language of living and dead labor to talk about things in ancient Italy, the Etruscans and whatnot. And he'll also use it to talk about in sort of a tangential ways and illusionary ways to talk about communism as well, post-capitalist and pre-capitalist scenarios. So that's a little bit of the theoretical background from Marx that Bordiga is working with here. And with that background covered, I think we're going to transition to talking about the texts now.
Tonight, here is the one thing that everybody seems to be missing. As world economies go down the tank and unemployment continues to rise, the disenfranchised people are set to explode. And now, the extreme left on this planet is actively calling for violence.
So Crane, what did you think about these articles, namely Murder of the Dead and Filling and Bursting of Bourgeois Civilization? I know you're a little bit more of a neophyte to the tradition of the Italian left than we are. Sam and I have been reading this stuff for, you know, several years now. So what did you think about these two articles?
So I thought that these were fantastic, especially because, you know, the way that Bordiga's background as a civil engineer comes up in here. And he talks about, you know, like the privatization of public works in these pieces. The way that he's then going to connect and he's going to say, you know, things like the monopoly capitalism, managed economy, controlled economy, in fact, presents nothing new. And to use like contemporary projects in civil engineering as a way to sort of identify and expand on or, you know, reveal the self-assertion of, like, the law of value, for instance, I think it's fantastic. So I really enjoyed these pieces. I think that it's much easier for me to understand why invariance was such a strong part of his life and thought after speaking with the two of you about this. It seems like it was a very strategic position that was also not strategic in the sense that he just thought it was right. And, you know, to his credit, he did seem to be right about a lot of things in advance. I know that while I was learning about this, I found out that he like wrote theses on fascism like less than a month after the March on Rome in the early 20s. So like he was ahead of the curve on a lot of this stuff. So I guess, you know, you can afford to be an invariant program person, especially when you have a track record like Bordiga does. But yeah, I guess I would say I'm very much impressed with the angle on civil engineering, which is not what I expected immediately from, you know, Bordiga's writings on the relationship between production process and nature, capital accumulation and nature. So much of it happens through the lens of being a civil engineer. I thought that it provides like a very unique perspective on this. Then the second thing would be I am finally starting to understand the connection between like his different writings and the concept of invariance and the invariant program. And so I thought that both of these were very helpful for that reason, especially given the sort of broad historical scope that he adopts in these pieces when he's talking about, like you said, like the Etruscans, the way that they managed the rivers relative to contemporary civil engineers.
Yeah. With regard to the whole thing about sort of monopoly capitalism and all that, one great part of this is he brings up in Murder of the Dead specifically is planned obsolescence. So I'll read a little a sentence here. He says, Bordiga says, modern capital, which needs consumers as it needs to produce ever more, has a great interest in letting the products of dead labor fall into disuse as soon as possible so as to impose their renewal with living labor, the only type from which it sucks profit. It's a reference to Marx's quip that capital lives vampire-like by sucking labor from the... he has a quote here. Capital is dead labor that vampire-like only lives by sucking living labor, blah, blah, blah. That's what Marx said back in, 1867. And he has a variety of examples of this. Cars are one, classic boomer engineer guy. The cars today aren't as good as the ones back in the day. He's saying this in the fucking 1952. So God knows what kind of car he's even talking about that was the good old days. Some kind of, Model T or something. Which I do know that Model Ts did last a long time. He talks about Ford built in 1920, so I think that would be a Model T. So maybe he was a Model T, he was a real shooter for a Model T. Didn't like the Fiats. Maybe he was the type of guy who dropped the line about, what Fiat stands for. Fix it again, Tony.
He was driving a jalopy, presumably.
Yeah.
But, the general point is that... it's in the interest of capital to let the elements of dead labor, that is, in the capitalist mode of production, constant capital, fall into disuse so that more living labor power, or that is to say, variable capital, can be thrown upon. And this is the analysis he provides to the flooding in Polesine, is that the wartime damage to the dams along the river could have easily been repaired, had the government had an interest in it. And indeed, when this flooding occurs, people just uncritically say that the government should just have some sort of state capitalist response where you just make people, you raise taxes to pay for the repairs and all that. But I think Bordiga's response is that there's something more structural going on, which is that the voracious appetite for surplus labor, the greed for surplus labor, means that under the capitalist mode of production, there will always be a need to throw more labor power onto capital to increase the rate of surplus value. Another element that he doesn't draw out specifically is this stuff about the organic composition of capital, which is sort of downstream in capital from the variable and constant capital discussion, right? So the ratio of those two is the organic composition of capital. And as the capitalist mode of production has a greater ratio of constant to variable capital, its rate of profit will be lessened because there's more, so to speak, overhead that needs to be paid for. And therefore, a lesser portion of the overall capital can be used for surplus value extraction. And so one answer is to just let the constant capital wither away or fall into disrepair, which is his analysis of what happens in Veneto in 1951.
He talks about productivism, this term, productivism, Mussolini's favorite creature, the idea that the government has a responsibility, the supposedly social democratic or the official communist idea, which is also shared by the fascists, that the government should always be building crazy infrastructure and all this stuff, which to him is misguided, if not, motivated by trying to produce, contracts for private building companies to build this stuff, because a lot of the old stuff worked better. It doesn't always need to be constantly modernized. If you build something to last, you won't need to have a full employment, industrial army of, infrastructure workers, because you'll build stuff that actually, doesn't break all the time. And in the other article in this short series on the flooding of the Po River Valley, which is Filling and Bursting of Bourgeois Civilization, he discusses the incorrect belief that the, quote, totalitarian form of the capitalist regime, namely fascism, gave overwhelming power to the state bureaucracy against the autonomous initiatives of enterprises and private speculation. On the contrary, Bordiga says, this form, which is fascism, is vital for capitalism's survival and that of the bourgeois class at a certain stage. It concentrates counter-revolutionary powers in the state machine, but renders the administrative machine weaker and more open to manipulation by speculative interests. So basically, his argument is that fascism is not this magical, efficient, you know, the myth, oh, Mussolini, at least he fucking kept the trains running on time or whatever. But actually, it's even more laden with graft and, you know, handing out spoils and sweetheart deals than normal liberal capitalism is. And there's a lot of historical evidence from beyond Italy for that. Of course, you know, in the U.S. now, every fucking, you know, billionaire capitalist guy is over there sucking Trump's dick, going over where the CEO of Apple gave him like a weird golden trophy or something a couple months ago. And of course, if you look at India, which some people will call a fascist regime, the Modi regime of the BJP party, there's very close ties between the BJP and the Modi specifically. And the, I think it's maybe the biggest like construction and like ship and like port company in India, which is the Adani Group, insanely large company that gets all kinds of special treatment from the government there. More and more examples from across the world can be listed out, but I think Sam has something he wants to say here.
I'd like to bring this back to Italy, specifically during the era of Mussolini, because there are some important things that Bordiga does not explain that underline this thesis. So he shouts out, or rather references, say shout outs imply some sort of positive reference, but he merely references a man by the name of Alberto De Stefani at one point in one of these articles, and then also Bertrand Russell at the end of Murder of the Dead. So who was De Stefani? He was an Italian economist who served as the first, one of the head economic advisors to Mussolini's regime during the 20s. And despite its appearance as a sort of state capitalist regime where, you know, something like a dirigismo, where like the state intervenes in capital, the early Italian fascist regime in the 20s, before they start gearing up for wartime production, is insanely privatized. Things that were previously held as sort of public utilities get privatized, so like rail and communication network, for instance, get privatized. I'm drawing in work from Clara Mattei here, who's done some very good work on the relationship between the logic of austerity and the fascist regimes. In particular, they were all obsessed with Vilfredo Pareto, who's, you know, stuff on Pareto optimality is still in modern orthodox economics, but whose stuff on elite theory also influenced fascism, right? So the idea that societies naturally will tend towards elite rule, and instead of trying to artificially enforce equality through something like democracy, you might as well just embrace that, so that that's sort of a Pareto optimal way to have a governmental system. There's a weird line at the end of Murder of the Dead after he criticizes Bertrand Russell for being a sort of Fabian style humanitarian left liberal socialist type who doesn't understand the nature of capitalism. So I think before I explain the cryptic final line, I should first explain the nature of the critique of Russell. So Russell is famous as a logician and to a lesser extent a mathematician, but by and large a philosopher and logician in the analytic sort of tradition. In fact, he sort of makes it with Frege and Wittgenstein. And as he gets older, especially around sort of the post-war period, he becomes the type of left liberal Fabian socialist that the UK is quite good at producing. So someone who doesn't really care that much about Marxism, but is still usually by and large okay with a sort of humanitarian style social democratic regime to provide people with the things they need to live like a dignified life and so on. There's one, and that usually comes along with pacifism. So during the Vietnam War, he, as a very old man, puts his name onto the Sartre Russell Tribunal to investigate war crimes in Vietnam, although because he's a very elderly man at that point, is not able to participate to the extent that one might think. But there's one bit here where Bordiga mentions the so-called Irish joke. Why should I care about my descendants? What have they ever done for me? And he uses this as a way to critique the type of sort of left-lib, social democrat, a curious attitude that people like Russell have, which is that capital only cares about reproducing, well, surplus value, right? And it doesn't care that much about these long-term humanitarian goals about, like, the march towards, you know, in implementing, you know, putative socialism through bit by bit through sort of reforms and such. And that the Irish joke, as it's called, this why should I care about my descendants, doesn't fully appreciate the fact that capital's short-term interest is what causes the inability for this long-term sort of concern for the good. And so it's almost a way for him to say, well, if Russell truly cared about these types of goals, then he should more thoroughly investigate the nature of capital as this enterprise which merely seeks to subordinate everything to the reproduction of surplus value. I will hold on the cryptic final lines. It sounds like Mr. Moran has something to say.
No, I don't have anything to say. You kind of took it in a different direction. So you can
then I'll explain the cryptic final line. Okay. We're back in. And this critique of the idea that sort of state intervention is sufficient to deal with the problems of capital comes in the very cryptic final line to Murder of the Dead, which I will read directly. Quote, just as Rockefeller came, big mustache must come. And that phrase is put in inverted commas, but not from the Kremlin. That one, despite Marx, is about to shave like an American. Now, that is not something that is very clear upon first read. Big mustache refers to Uncle Joe, that is Stalin, who's still alive in 51. It's a pun that does not translate very well to English. So someone who has a mustache, or a mustache in Italian is baffi. And so big mustache would be baffoni. And a buffoon or an idiot would be a buffone. So it's a play on words to indicate that Stalin is a bit of an idiot for thinking that you can have something like socialist commodity production or sort of a state-run capitalist regime and have that with a socialist flair and have that suffice for socialism. This idea is that this type of state intervention in the economy, which we're seeing more and more and more and more people are doing it, at this point, you still got something approaching like, this was the time of like military Keynesianism and such. There's this widespread view that that despite the state intervention in the economy, this does not suffice to make something socialist. And critically, it's insufficient to deal with the real problem, which is this voracious appetite for surplus labor that will continue to exist regardless of whether something is state-owned or whether it's privately held. So that's what this cryptic final line in Murder of the Dead is trying to get at, is that even the so-called socialist regimes are prey to this type of thinking about capital that is insufficient to deal with the problem at hand.
Moving the discussion on to some other works by Bordiga from the 1950s and 60s, he has this essay from 1956 called Weird and Wonderful Tales of Modern Social Decadence that's mainly about a ship that sank around that time. But he also has a discussion of a coal mine disaster. It was actually a Belgian coal mine, although a lot of Italian workers were trapped in this disaster. Crane, I know you were really taken by his analysis of this this sort of the unique way that such disasters are approached under capitalism.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is also something that comes up in his, when he's doing the long view perspectives, even in the two about the flooding of the Po River Valley, where he's talking about like sort of the destruction of the inherited infrastructure of, you know, like keeping the rivers at bay down from the time of the Etruscans and stuff like that, where really what he's talking about is there's a way in which capitalism can neither secure, maybe you could use even like Marx's formula, the health of the worker or the quality of the soil. And in fact, it actively undermines both of those. And so it undermines like the natural conditions of production at the same time it's going to like murder everyone who's like fed into the slaughterhouse of the production process. And this is something that we see in his analysis of the coal mine. What I liked about it, what I really liked about it was that he talks about, you know, the problem of when there's a collapse in the coal mine and these people have to be fished out. The problem is, sorry, I lost my quote. Found it. All right. So what really comes out in the context of his discussion of the coal mine collapse is that the way that the mining process is done is they want to reduce the number of holes that are going down to where the coal is mined. And this is because if there's too much oxygen down there, the oxidization process is going to eat away at the coal. And so there's a huge drop, you know, in profitability every time there's another opening that's made. And this is something that becomes a crisis specifically in the context of the collapse, where he says that the clear response for the company, if they couldn't still hear the screams of those who had survived the collapse saying, someone come save us, rescue us from the mine, the clear solution would have been, it would have been more profitable for the company not to go down there at all. And in fact, he even talks about these weird compensation, rules for compensation in the mines, which date back a long time on his account. And it's something like the workers receive compensation even after their death, given the amount of time that their dead bodies are still in the mine. They have to finish off their shift after their death, in other words. And that will determine like the compensation that their family receives. So he says then, yeah, the solution, if the maddened shouts of the survivors had not been raised too high, would have been simple. Close all the entrances. Without oxygen, everything falls silent. The oxidization of the coal and the analogous process of, in man, which we call life, and therefore the ability of the miners to voice, to scream their cries up, please someone reopen one of the old holes from the other side of the mine that had been closed off, save us. And so he says that there's a moment where, you know, the workers are saved. Some of them are at the very least. And the caskets are brought up, you know, for like a closed casket funeral. And some of the family members who are there in attendance, some of the women and the wives of the miners who were stuck down in the mine, they say, at one point, they break down during the funeral procession and they say, how are we supposed to know that those are the bodies of our husbands in there? And you didn't just use the caskets themselves to ship up more of the coal that you're then going to sell on the market. So the reason I like this, though, was because he has this line about what cannot happen in a commodity society, if that's how we're defining capitalism. Get all the survivors out, then close the entrance forever. And so he says that this is something commodity society will never be able to say. And I think that what's interesting here is that for a few things, one of them is that the emancipation of the workers does have like an immediate effect on like the chemical processes to which the coal is subjected. This is also why when Bordiga is going to say some relatively bong rip things about, you know, like the liberation of electrons, sunlight, flows of rivers, draft animals and human beings from the compulsions of capital accumulation. And especially you know, with the reduction of labor time that happens with communist mechanization, and, you know, production being directly indexed to needs rather than us all being locked in these vast automatons that are, you know, fucking eating us, but tend to be very good up to a certain point until they have to be destroyed as infrastructure for, you know, the accumulation of capital. But he's going to say then that there is something that happens to the coal itself and to, like, the chemical process of oxidation with the emancipation of human beings. It doesn't mean that he's doing a Haraway, you know, oxygen molecules and the coal have feelings too, they have interiority, whatever. But what he's saying is that there is a direct relationship between, like, energetic processes and the human production process, such that there will be something like a world historical, natural historical transformation of the earth itself with the emancipation of human beings. That's one of the things that I found so interesting about this piece. And if I may, this is where I would say that there's a fundamental, or I would hazard there's a fundamental conceptual core in these pieces. And it's a distinction between capitalist mechanization, which is the dead murdering the dead. And this is, you know, like dead labor sucking from the living, the right to exploit living labor versus, and then the need to destroy constant capital at a certain point. Then there's communist mechanization, which he describes as the guardianship of the living later in Murder of the Dead. Here it is a matter of slow, non-accelerable centuries of long transmission from generation to generation of the results of dead labor, but under the guardianship of the living, of their lives, and of their lesser sacrifice. And this is supposed to undermine the core contradiction, he calls, between the convulsive dynamic of contemporary supercapitalism and all the sound requirements for the organization of the life of human groups on the earth, allowing them to transmit good living conditions through time. So this is where I think this fundamental conceptual distinction that he's introducing, and he does it in the spirit of horsepower as well, between communist mechanization and capitalist mechanization. He'll say that technically the energy relation in capitalism is physically true in a technical sense, but it's socially false, and therefore it's also naturally false. And I think that this comes out very well, all of this fits very well into the example of the coal mine, and which is also why his complete devotion to humanism and human emancipation also has direct ramifications for our relationship to nature and the environment around us. That's why I like the coal stuff so much.
Yeah. And in relation to the idea of communist mechanization, I'd like to discuss, I'll just sort of list these out, some of the intriguing communist policies, both positive and negative, that Bordiga proposed throughout the 50s and 60s. The first one is, he was a proponent of geoengineering. He wanted to divert rivers in Central Asia in order to make all of Central Asia into a agricultural powerhouse. He said in an article called Land, Blood, and Water in English. I don't remember exactly what year it's from, but he says, if Russia was the country of revolution today, they would first of all blow up the White House, and then they would set to work diverting the Amu Darya, which is a large river in Central Asia that has its origins in the Himalayas, I think. In another one, he talks about wanting to abolish the distinction between town and country by means of complete equalization of population density. There's an idea he took from a remark from Engels in his classic work, The Housing Question. Related to that, he wants to suppress all useless traffic, so get rid of all the cars, only Model Ts and Fiats on the road, I guess. With regard to the treatment of productive, like, utilities or whatever, he believes in, like, a universal principle of usufruct, so rejection of property in the sense of all, like, monopoly, because he thinks even people in the present do not hold a monopoly over the productive organism of society. I think they have a duty to pass this productive organism down to future generations. He wants a total replacement of capitalist technology to the point of putting the old shit in a museum for display, complete retirement of it because it's so environmentally destructive. He proposes this at the end of an article called The Human Species and Earth's Crust. He has, throughout all of these policies, you can detect a very clear admiration for the daring imagination of the utopian socialists. For it has said that Marx's critique of the utopians was not that they were too fantastic, but that they were twisted replicas of capitalism. The fantastic part of their theories is something that Bordiga clearly admires about them. And I can actually read out a complete list of the immediate demands of the revolution here that he prepared in, 1953. This is a couple of points here. So, and this is supposed to be like a modernization of the 10 planks that Marx and Engels put forward in the Communist Manifesto for the 21st century. The first one is de-investment of capital, which means of production are assigned a smaller proportion in relation to consumer goods. Increase of production costs, so more money for less labor time. Drastic reduction of labor time, at least by half, as unemployment and socially useless and damaging activities will shortly become things of the past. A reduction in the mass of what is produced through a, quote, underproduction plan, which is to say the concentration of production on what is necessary, as well as a, quote, authoritarian regulation of consumption, by which the promotion of useless, damaging, and luxury consumption goods is combated and activities which propagate a reactionary mentality are violently prohibited. This is coupled with a rapid dissolution of the boundaries of the enterprise, so the assignment of production decisions to higher bodies that control multiple enterprises at once instead of having enterprise-by-enterprise management. Rapid abolition of social services, whereby handouts and welfare are replaced by a social minimum for anyone who is incapable of work. A construction freeze on the rings of housing and workplaces around major and small cities in order to equalize the population, as I mentioned before. A decisive struggle against professional specialization and the social division of labor. And immediate measures to put the schools, the press, and all means of communication and information, as well as the entire spectrum of cultural and entertainment under the control of the communist state. That is his immediate program. That is day one for Amadeo Bordiga. You know, what's the fucking saying? Shoot for the moon, you land among the stars type shit.
Is this before or after the attack on Washington?
That's a good question. I think it's maybe simultaneously. Well, in the thing he said, first bomb Washington, then divert the river. So I guess Bordiga, I will say one thing, very extremely anti-American. Absolutely one of the most anti-American people maybe in history. So I think blowing up the White House would be the first step. That would be day zero. That would be even before you start, you know, giving people $1 million for, you know, 15 minutes of work or whatever and blowing up all suburbs or whatever. And throughout all of these demands, you can sort of see that he has a balancing act between accounting for the present demands made by nature and the satisfaction of needs and the duty to pass down the productive organism of society as a patrimony to future generations instead of destroying it and building dog shit that, you know, breaks after a couple of years or whatever. Sam, do you have any other wacky stuff from Bordiga or just interesting stuff from Bordiga in these texts that piqued your interest at all?
I mean, the main thing, right, is that it kind of comes off like Boomer yelling at points, like that bit in The Spirit of Horsepower about the planned obsolescence of automobile manufacturing. And then there's the similar complaints about dam manufacturing in The Legend of the Piave. What I would like to actually say is that this is not supposed to be too wacky in the sense of the utopian socialism, right? So the bit you just read out about how Marx's critique of the utopians wasn't that they were shooting for the moon, so to speak, but because they were, so to speak, still stuck within a framework of capital. That this is supposed to be a scientific program in multiple senses of the word. That is, not only is it supposed to be built off of the, you know, putative science of socialism, historical materialism as such, but also because he's a engineer, the technical demands of engineering, as well as the relationship between man and the environment. I really think of this as a perhaps unwitting sort of sister piece, as if you will, to the concern about the domination over nature in Dialectic of Enlightenment, and that was a big motivating force in trying to pick it. In that it sees there's a certain relationship that capital has tried to create between man and the environment, one of sort of one-sided domination, that is itself a one-sided abstraction that fails to realize that we're part of the environment, and that there's a sort of duty, so to speak, to pass on the dead labor, because we're no longer talking about capital in a pre-capitalist or post-capitalist society, but the dead labor as it is in congealed and river and dams and whatnot onto the next generation. The main thing I'd like to reemphasize is that while these are supposed to be seen, while these might strike people as outlandish, they're not supposed to be seen as such. That is, they're supposed to be coming from a real demand. That is, a demand that human beings have a specific relationship to their environment and to the dead labor that precedes them, and hopefully should be passed down onto their descendants. So the, so to speak, wacky or zany elements are zany only from the point of view of capital, which enforces a specific one-sided determination vis-a-vis sort of man's relationship to nature. So that's all I really have.
Yeah, so I want to say something here, especially about, you know, the relationship between nature and the sort of utopian aspect, because both of these come up in the Human Species in the Earth's Crust piece from also from the early 50s, where he's talking about Marx's writings on Liebig, the agrochemist. And he talks about how in his writings on the chemistry of agriculture, Marx says, Liebig's, the first demand has always been that man shall give back to the land what he takes from it, and in which he proves that that only the existence of the towns, in particular the big towns, prevents this. And this has to do with, if I remember correctly, the nitrogen cycle, right? And sort of other soil fertility.
Minerals and elements are involved in that, but nitrogen is a main one, yeah.
And yeah, so it has to do with like soil fertility. And this is like part of the problem where it's with human waste product, right?
Yeah. Night soil, as it used to be called. And you know, let me tell you this. There used to be a special name for people who would collect the night soil in medieval England. They were called gong farmers.
That's what I'm going to be in the post-capitalist commune. I'm going to be a gong farmer.
Or you're going to farm
people? Yeah. I'll be a dung beetle.
I mean, I guess I'll be a
communist dung beetle. If there were no dung beetles, I'll be like a reverse dung beetle, because dung beetles make sure that poop doesn't cover like the entire African continent, right? But for me, it'll be to spread poop over from where it is concentrated. See, that's what I'll be doing.
This is DEI-aria. So I am leaving that in from the start. I'm leaving that in.
But what I like is that, you know, Bordiga is going to say, we should not consider as outmodus the thesis of Liebig, which says the rotating cycle of organic matter necessary to life will become deficient if we relinquish the waste of humans and part of that of animals. And so he talks about like problems of urban hygiene. He talks about like problems of food shortage. He has this weird digression at this point about the possibility of farming plankton blooms in the water of the sea. But yeah, so he keeps going and he'll say something like, setting aside these futuristic visions, the cycle of the land, agriculture, animals, humans today is deficient, particularly in substances containing nitrogen. Why then neglect the enormous losses due to the present systems of sterilization of waste, while the mineral reserves of some types of fertilizer are close to exhaustion? And so he continues on to say that this is something that shows up incidentally. This is not the primary problem. The primary problem is waste. But it's also in the preservation of dead bodies, which is that our bodies don't go back into, like, we don't put back in our bodies. We don't put our bodies back into nature in the same way anymore. And that this has itself effects in, you know, what you call a metabolic rift of interrupting sort of these cycles through which, in this case, the fertility of the soil would be renewed. And so he says, yes, obviously it's negligible. The sum of waste excreted by a man in the course of an average life represents around 300 times the weight of his body. So obviously the biggest problem is poop. But he does say that the human species destroys innumerable masses of calories in this vital sector, the preservation of dead bodies. And he says, don't worry, we don't want to industrialize corpses like the Nazis did. So it's not about producing bodies for fertilizer, but it's about what our bodies, the relationship that dead bodies have to these cycles in nature, which we ought to be able to rationally regulate in the metabolism between society and nature. And so he says he entertains the possibility of replacing the cemeteries by some other system, mineralizing corpses to gain in cultivable land. Today, this would be for the promoters of tempting, building land. But let's have no confusion about this. It's not on their behalf that we're taking up the cudgels. This is where he talks about utopia. And this is the reason I brought up this passage, where he says, when we plan these, you know, speculative projects, for example, the uniform network of infrastructure over the Earth's crust, in which the distinction between town and country will be abolished with like the redistribution of the human species and like the terraforming of the planet. He says, we are situating ourselves, therefore, with Marx and Engels, not on the terrain of utopia or vague hypotheses, but in the framework of a precise post-revolutionary and post-capitalist program. And I think this is something that's interesting and important, which is that the reason it's non-utopian is because it is a program for action. And so I think that as this is, you know, also one of the famous problems that Marx and Engels have with the utopian socialists. This is the problem that goes all the way back to Thomas More's Utopia, which is that it assumes sort of like a divine king Utopos figure who's going to like isolate the peninsula that utopia is going to be on from the rest of the world. But he has to be endowed with like this magic, transcended power of sovereignty to create the utopia in the first place. And other utopians, Fourier and others, they don't have like ideas about what the transition would look like, right? Into post-modern in the sense of capitalist society.
They do have an idea, so, it's really stupid. Like their idea is like Fourier's idea is give me money, I'll build the phalanxes and everyone will say, that's so awesome, I want to join.
Oh yeah, Robert Owen also has like that with the intentional community stuff. Yeah. Yeah, so they're stupid ideas of transition. Well, so like what Bordiga's thing is like, it's not utopian because it's not a stupid idea of transition. And it understands like the class reality of the situation and the problem of class struggle. But yeah, that's why he says it's non-utopian. And this is also where like, when we're talking about the unity of sort of like, you know, the emancipation of human beings from the capitalist production process, the demands of capital accumulation, assertion of the law of value, et cetera. And then that of like energetic processes, rivers, animals. This is something that also comes up in the context of metabolism. So Marx, when he's reading Liebig, he's going to have this, he's going to be reading Liebig's writing about the guano imperialism of the United States and the English in their desperate
Guano
search
Island
for
Act.
These. Yeah. And so like the problem is, so they send like, they send people there to work who are like Chinese indentured laborers, peoples who are, you know, enslaved and subject to horrible, brutal working and living conditions there. The people who were living on the islands there, you know, were killed in the process. All of the birds, like the penguins themselves, were killed in the process of extracting the guano. So this only happened for like a very short period of time. But this is one of those cases where it's very clear that like, that's why there are immediate ramifications for our relationship to nature with the emancipation of like human beings from the compulsions of the capitalist production process. So like, I think that this is, you know, to Bordiga's credit, this is one of those places where some of those more bong rip moments I feel are definitely warranted.
Yeah, I agree that a lot of the stuff is warranted, but I do have to push back on Sam's judgment that it is not wacky. It is still wacky, especially the stuff about blowing up the fucking Himalayas to turn the Central Asian plains into a fucking agricultural wonderland like Khrushchev wanted to do. you know, the Virgin Lands campaign. Because effectively what he's proposing is a gigantic Virgin Lands campaign on the scale of an entire continent. It's wacky. You can admit that it's wacky. The other stuff, I think, and also like the dictatorial control over consumption to get rid of all the, we were discussing a little bit before we started recording that Bordigo was a teetotaler and was absolutely opposed to the smoking of cigarettes and the drinking of any alcohol. He thought that that stuff would be no longer constructed after, you know, communism took over, which, you know, if he's looking at like the primitive communism, those guys love getting drunk. They love getting high. Everyone loves getting drunk and getting high. They love drinking fermented mushroom juice, whatever, you know, a palm wine, you know, shit like this, whatever. They love that crap. So a little bit undialectical of him to be like that.
It definitely is. Also, you know, like this is the thing, which is like animals, as soon as they figure out about like fermented fruits, they'll like get drunk off of
the
them.
Monkeys.
I think some species like berry fruits until they get fermented and then get fucked up off of them. Yeah, so look, I'm not saying that just because it's natural, it's good, but I'm saying that for as per Bordiga's own position, I don't think he can just dismiss it as like a modern decadence or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, this also gets us, though, especially when we're talking about, you know, like the primitive communism stuff. This takes us, I think, to the last piece that we are discussing for today.
Yes.
Which is in Unitio, death is not scary. So does someone want to talk about that? Introduce it.
I can just give the very brief background. I'm going to let you kind of start with talking about it, but I'll just get the brief background of it. This is an article from 1961. The sort of topical framing device he uses for this is some little pamphlet, an Italian children's comic that he found that talks about human sacrifice in like the Aztec Empire and the Day of the Dead and the connection between the ancient Aztec. It's not really that ancient when you think about it, but, you know, the pre-Columbian religion in Mexico and its connection to the modern day Day of the Dead, which is coming up soon. And he sort of uses that as a springboard to talk about his own ideas about the relationship between pre-capitalist society and post-capitalist communist society and the relationship of people to life and death in these kinds of societies.
And so, you know, this is also one of the great parts of his anti-Americanism, where the first paragraph that's his own, which is not just quoting from this source, that's like describing Day of the Dead celebrations, is just like filled with like just vitriol for United States, quote, cultural, unquote, production, which passed from tabloid to tabloid and from review to review without the hacks and service noticing anything other than the degree of effect each piece that circulates. But this is where he's going to say that, this is ancient communism is going to be introduced here, where he's going to say the noble Mexican population, having become Catholic under the merciless terror of the Spanish invaders, would show that they have remained primitive, in quotes, by not being terrified and horrified of death. And he says these peoples are, however, the heirs of a civilization misunderstood by Christians, then and now transmitted down from ancient communism. Insipid modern individualism can only be flabbergasted by it. And so he says, true unknown dead, because he's talking about how in this text there's a description that graves are unmarked, dishes are prepared even for those dead who no one remembers. He continues, true unknown dead, not because a sluggish demagogic rhetoric says so, but through the powerful simplicity of a life which is of the species and for the species, eternal like nature, and not like a stupid swarm of souls wandering in the beyond for whose development the experiences of the dead, the living, and the as yet unborn are valid, in an historical sequence whose unfolding is not mourning, but joy in all the moments of the material cycle itself. So this gets at another quote that you brought up to my attention, J.E., from the article on the human species and the Earth's crust published in 52, which is where he lays down like the fundamental distinction. This is right after he makes that civilization and syphilization pun. He says, for us Marxists, man is the species. For bourgeois gentlemen, man is the individual. And this is the conceptual key to getting over the fear of death in sort of the rapprochement we're going to have with our own species being under communism on his model. So let's talk about, who wants to talk about the human sacrifice part?
Anyone? Human sacrifice? I'll take it. I'll take it then. So famously, or perhaps infamously, Bordiga has some positive words about human sacrifice in this piece, which was infamously practiced by the Aztecs and the Inca, the two most sort of magnificent states in the Americas at the time of the arrival of Europeans. So he mentions that Marx was an admirer of the Incan civilization, and this is kind of true. Marx referred to them as communist a couple of times, and they come up a handful of times in various works by Marx. And Bordiga says it is not what Marx admired about the Inca was not that they were, quote, primitive and ferocious enough to sacrifice the most beautiful specimens of their young to the sun who cried out for human blood, but that such a community, magnificent and powerfully intuitive, recognized the flow of life in that same energy which the sun radiates on the planet and which flows through the arteries of a living man, and which becomes unity and love in the whole species, which, until it falls into the superstition of an individual soul with its sanctimonious balance sheet of give and take, the superstructure of monetary venality, does not fear death and knows personal death as nothing more than a hymn of joy and a fecund contribution to the life of humanity. And he says, in primitive communism, humanity is conceived within the limits of the horde. The individual does not aim to subtract wealth from his brother, but rather is willing to be sacrificed without the slightest fear for the survival of the great phratry. And phratry is it's an old Greek term. They were the tribes that made up the Athenian society. Just as a little piece of trivia here, in a later article by the International Communist Party, they sort of tried to one-up Bordiga on this, and they talked about how in some societies, the elderly are traditionally culled, whether beaten to death with clubs or they just walk off to go die on their own. And they say, that is also an example of communist mastery over life and death. And I'll kind of leave it as an exercise to the audience, whether you think they were right about that. You can find the article. It's called When Death Is Not Scary. You can find it on the International Communist Party's website. And decide for yourself if they have a point about that or not.
As an interjection here, so yes, I obviously defer to, you know, the wisdom and the genius of the masses listening to this. But at the same time, I also think that it's important to say that the key to his understanding of this kind of dynamic in which the fear of death is overcome because of the relationship between the individual life and that of the species, as he says, in communism, which has not yet happened, but which remains a scientific certainty, this is at the end of In Unitio, he says, the identity of the individual and his fate with the species is re-won. After destroying within it all the limits of family, race, and nation, this victory puts an end to all fear of personal death, with it every cult of the living and the dead, society being organized for the first time around well-being and joy and the reduction of sorrow, suffering, and sacrifice to a rational minimum, removing every mysterious and sinister character from the harmonious course of the succession of generations, a natural condition of the prosperity of the species. And so this is where I just want to say, like, he is going to bring up at multiple times in all these articles the reduction of the need for people to sacrifice at all. And this is where I would push back. It's also where he continues to say things like, we are going to stop maintaining a lot of, you know, like the grand industrial machineries of the bourgeois age at the end of the human species and the Earth's crust, where he'll say that we can leave some of them as sort of archaeological curiosities for people to marvel at, you know, the monstrosities from before the worldwide explosion of the communist revolution. But like, he's very clear in this sense that he considers any argument, I feel, in these pieces for the sacrifice of individuals, whether it's like in Stakhanovism, in his critique of Stakhanovism, or, you know, like the USSR's labor heroism of the individual. He considers this to be tied to the essentially capitalist character of the production process there. So, like, this is where I would push back against their article, I think. And what I would suggest as what I think is a bong rip response at the level of his own suggestions is that, as he says in The Human Species in the Earth's Crust, the point is not to industrialize the production of bodies like the Nazis did, such that we could then fertilize the soil, because, again, that's not as important as the poop stuff. But the point that he's going to make there, I think, about why it is that we would want to, or we should consider putting our bodies back into these cycles that, you know, like improve the fertility of the soil, rather than, you know, even something like what he insisted on, I would say that this is to not be utopian, but to be revolutionary and scientific in a communist program, which is that I feel this must demonstrate the need for something like the return of sky burials and the process of sky burials, which would be a much more direct way, I think, of returning ourselves in a way that has an immediate effect on, you know, like the well-being of the species that we share the earth with. In this case, it would be vultures, who, by the way, are dying off in huge numbers all over the world because of the way that, like, rat poison is used to poison the predators that kill livestock. So then, like, the lions go get their family, they eat first, then the hyenas, then the vultures. The vultures die off because the farmer has poisoned the corpse of their livestock. And this is something that also, it's because these farmers aren't being taken care of. You can't just penalize them for this because the livestock is, like, every individual head of cattle is, like, life or death for them. So, again, Bordiga vindicated by the vulture crisis. And I would say this proves the need for the restoration of vulture populations and is evidence for the scientific revolutionary dialectical argument for the return of sky burials.
I'm not sure how I'm exactly supposed to pick up the thread at that point, but I would just like to conclude or maybe put a bow on the two main threads that we've discussed today, which is the way in which capital creates a schism between humanity and nature, and then the way in which it creates a schism between man and the species. And the main thing I'd like to say is that it's just two parts of the same overall process. That is, the alienation of man from nature is part of an alienation of man from man, or rather from man and species, and that the reconciliation of man to nature necessarily entails a reconciliation of man to the species as opposed to the individual qua individual. And so the reason why we wanted to end with Janizio is it's in its own way a sort of schematic for a post-capitalist society in which those two elements have been reconciled, or those two reconciliations have taken place. The individual person is no longer an individual who is divorced from or held in an antagonistic relation, an antagonistic relationship to one's fellow person, but as part of the overall human species, an inheritor of the dead labor of the past and a guardian of it for the future, and is similarly no longer able to instrumentalize nature as a mere means to the self-expansion of capital, but is reconciled to it as part of an overall sort of process. That is, one recognizes now that one lives in nature and is no longer an antagonist toward it. So I will end my spiel there.
Antagonistic is a great slip here, actually. Just as a final getting my edge in, you know, because the central conflict of Antigone about her brother's burial and about, you know, the relationship between bodies and the polis, which is like, look, the way that we solve the problem between, like, you know, the allegedly natural family and then the rule of law in the state, Antigone versus Creon, is also through abolishing the antithesis between town and country with the revolutionary program that Bordiga lays out in these pieces.
Yeah, and when we're talking about wackiness, the equalization of population is also wacky. Like, it's not a good idea. Just even from the perspective of modern ecology, everyone thinks it's not a good idea. Cities are actually considered like a good idea compared to spreading everyone out, I think, nowadays.
But
now we're going to call it a day here. We're going to wrap up this episode. if anyone is interested in reading more about Boardia, we'll maybe try to have a couple of links to stuff that we talked about in the notes for this episode. If you want to read a little bit about him and the Italian left, there is an introduction to the book, The Science and Passion of Communism. It's an anthology of writings by Boardia. It came out a few years ago. There was also a historical study of the Italian left by Philippe Borinet. You can find that on websites like Libcom, as well as on Borinet's own website, which I don't remember the URL of right now. If you're interested in learning more about Boardia. But that's going to wrap up the episode for today. Make sure to subscribe to us. We're trying to put the podcast on all the proper streaming platforms now. Subscribe, like it, or whatever. Leave a review. All the shit that people are supposed to do for podcasts. I don't really know. I think that's mainly the stuff you want to do. Subscribe and leave a review. I don't think you can like podcasts, actually. But yeah.
Yeah, and register then by doing so for the future poop farmers core of inverse dung beetles in communist society. Yeah. I will see you all there.
Yeah, we have a 20-part series about poop coming up, so look forward to that. But in all seriousness, we are trying to put this out more regularly. So hopefully if you do subscribe, it will be, you will actually get notifications about it. But that, we are actually signing off now. Goodbye. Goodbye. What the fuck am I saying? End of podcast.